Well, thank you. I think we've caught up most of our time now. We have a very short item now, which is report back from your very varied discussions. But of course, we will capture all that in better ways as well, but we'll just see where we are. Can I draw your attention? I mentioned it this morning very, very quickly. Our languages, you've got a folder there, which you could have. Thanks to Silt and Sarah, who got them brought over. Do you want to say 30 seconds about that, Sarah, what it is? Put your thingy on if we need it. Haven't you got a book? There's a microphone there.
Oh, thank you. Is that better? Right, yes. So just to say, you've got the two packs inside, so you need to assemble it, I'm afraid, the dividers and the content. It has a varied audience, but I think the aim was to bring together the two sectors. And by two sectors, I mean the mainstream sector in the UK, primary and secondary schools, with voluntary schools, or as we call them, we've decided to use the terminology, complementary schools. All community with a small c, all community languages that are taught in complementary schools. And there are many cross-references to the website in the toolkit. So if you're interested in finding out more about this DCSF project, please do look at the website, because you'll see some extra things there that are not in the toolkit. So there's a number of film clips that you might find, I think, useful to your own work, which are on the website. There's a chapter here on family learning, of which Charmaine Kenner is an expert and can talk to you about here. There's also quite a lot of information on how to become a qualified teacher in the UK. And the bulk of the toolkit is about how to form and maintain a partnership. So it's all about, really, community cohesion through language and sharing, very much following the Every Child Matters agenda, putting the child, the individual, at the heart of the curriculum and valuing the child's extra school experiences and learning.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for that very full 30 seconds. And actually, before we take the report back, sorry, Charmian, I've got you up here under false pretenses, but do stay there. We were hoping this morning to allow a few minutes for Christina Cunningham from the Commission, just to say a few things about some of the perspectives of this from the Commission. I think you can probably do it from there, unless you particularly want to struggle up here and put on the microphone, which should be, or can we take the microphone round there rather than...
Okay. I'll try to keep it to 2 minutes, and also the additional challenge will be not to repeat what I already said in our interesting discussion group this morning. The Multilingualism Policy Unit has been very much in focus throughout the last 3 years, as we have been working intensively together with Leonard Orban, the Commissioner for Multilingualism, and his team, to try to define and develop the multilingualism policy for Europe. Now, after having listened to the three presentations in the morning session today, giving such enormously diverse pictures of how a national policy can be defined and implemented in three different countries, I think you can all imagine what it is like trying to define an education policy for languages in 27 countries in Europe. It is a vast task. As you might be aware, the essentials of this policy have been defined in a policy document, in a communication from the Commission, with the title, it's in the scoping document, and right now I'm a bit lost for words, Multilingualism, an Asset for Europe and a Shared Commitment. That is the title of this beautiful document, which is the last one, and it's still valid. We are still working on the implementation of this policy document, and we will indeed continue doing so under the new commissioner, who will hopefully be manage her parliamentary hearing grilling in the end of January, so that she, together with her colleagues, can enter her new office in February next year. It's a Cypriot lady. Her name is Androula Vassiliou. I don't know if I pronounce it properly. And she will by no means be the commissioner for only multilingualism, but it will be back to what we had before 2007, namely a commissioner for education, culture and multilingualism, which might be logical. Now, of course, it will be a little bit more of a challenge to try to continue to push language questions, language policy, within this huge, enormous portfolio of our new commissioner, who will indeed have to be more selective than Leonard Orban when determining what to endorse, what to do, where to participate. I think what we managed to do during this window of opportunity that we had with Orban was to make people both within the commission, both within the European institutions and out in the member states, more aware of the transversal aspect of language issues in a wide spectrum of policies. And building on that, we will continue to pursue these challenges in the new constellation, and I hope that with the help of you who are here today, and other both academics and practitioners that work on different aspects of language policies within your various areas of responsibility, we will continue to pursue this important work together. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christina. I just to add one very small point. I think what's been very interesting about the development of the documentation, as Christina has described it, as I've observed it, is that it seems to follow the same kind of passage as some of the national policies in, for example, recognising that there were languages outside Europe which were also coming into Europe, and that's also reflected in the programme. So it's very much that agenda which I think we're trying to get to grips with now in policy and theoretical terms. It's now we're going to take in reverse order, and I don't know whether I can be fierce or I can just rely on them to be wonderful, but we're trying to get our time back just to get some pointers of three or four things of interest coming out of the groups, starting with Charmian, who had notionally group three. And if you come and stand here, Charmian, you might even get filmed.
Okay, is this picking up the microphone? Yep, great, okay. We discovered an interesting contradiction, which other people may also have discovered, that there can be, say, for example, young people who are multilingual in the sense that they know one or two other foreign languages and are very happy that they could speak to people in other countries, but at the same time may not be comfortable, or the people in their country may not generally be comfortable with the languages that are there within their own country in terms of social cohesion. And there was this very interesting example from Bulgaria about the Turkish community that for many years has had 10 minutes of news in Turkish on the main TV station, and now that's people are asking for a referendum or have got a referendum about to challenge that 10 minutes of Turkish, even though the young people in Bulgaria might be quite happily, you know, bilingual or trilingual in a couple of other languages. So you could have that contradiction. Why is that happening? One reason can be the perceptions of European languages as more important for employability, which is not always the case, because actually Bengali or Punjabi can be just as important as trading languages and so on. But that perception very often drives policy, and it drives parental choices or some parental choices. So what can we do about that? We need to engage with that quite directly, with those perceptions, to try and change them and offer alternatives, and making the argument that plurilingualism is important for all. It's a useful and important benefit in all languages, not just a few, is a really important argument to make. It shouldn't just be for the few people who happen to be born bilingual, you know, through chance. It should be spread to everybody. And how can that be done? We had some very good examples of children learning, for example, Somali in Sheffield, all children in the class learning, and Bengali in East London, that actually children both learn languages and it contributes to social cohesion. It's very successful. And we had a nice example of children learning languages through football and becoming interested in other languages and other cultures through the medium of that, which can address a constituency that doesn't always get involved in multilingualism. And we had a nice example from the university in Parma of when the Erasmus students come, instead of allowing them to form little cliques, which means that, you know, multilingualism is not effectively happening, of actually asking them to engage with each other and actually become, you know, build up intercultural understanding. So we need to be engaging with all these things. With regard to identities, it also means making other identities possible. And one possibility was identities based around cities. You know, I'm a Bradford person. I've lived here for 50 years. I originate from the Indian subcontinent, but, you know, the Asian subcontinent, but that's, I'm a Bradford person. I'm a Sheffield person. I'm a Londoner. I'm a person from Utrecht or from other cities. But we also thought it involved a deeper understanding of your own identity and your own culture, both on the part of the so-called indigenous people in each country and on the part of the relative newcomers to each country. And Keith raised the interesting question, what about a national identity? Is it actually necessary to have a national identity for social cohesion? If so, can it be a plurilingual national identity? And I think we didn't answer that question. Maybe we can discuss that this afternoon, because if we don't try and answer that question, we're left with the situation that the so-called national identity can be called upon at any time by politicians who quite cynically can exploit that idea, you know, rather with the Turkish example again of we don't want this Turkish on TV, do we? You know, because we're all Bulgarians here. So, you know, we that's always going to raise its head unless we directly address it.
I was in that conversation. I never realised it was so coherent. That sounds absolutely... that sounds absolutely wonderful. Perhaps we can find out the same, Viv, whether your conversation ended up as coherent.
Well, very, very much the edited highlights here. We set out wanting to discuss policy and obviously practice. We spent rather more time talking about policy. We broadened out from the policy context that we've been talking about in the morning, Ireland, England and France, to look at the broader European policy framework. So it's very useful having Christina in the group there. We talked about the shift in EC thinking from the learning of European languages to the learning of world languages, progression which is very clear when you compare what the aims of the Lingua programme were with the new seven-year programme. The point was made that what's been advocated in the new seven-year programme is more at the level of aspiration than reality. But again, work is already in progress for the following seven-year programme, and hopefully at that time things will start to become more solid. and at least there is evidence here of people moving in the right direction. We spent quite a lot of time talking about monolinguals as an excluded group. And at least I personally have come to the conclusion that this is a potentially huge issue which really needs detailed unpicking. Lyd talked this morning in terms of this group being of a certain class and a certain gender. But it's likely that this is going to be a much more complex issue. For instance, the monolingual group may very well include third and fourth generation kids who've lost their mother tongues as a result of subtractive bilingual education policies. So I think that that's something which really needs to be looked at in a lot more detail. We also looked at the poor outcomes of language teaching. I think in the sort of Anglophone world, we tend to think of that in terms of being a particularly English-speaking dilemma. But it's obviously it's not. I mean, the example that David gave this morning of Ireland, we also had the example of Belgium, where children are expected to French-speaking children are expected to learn Flemish as their first foreign language. And where the outcomes are very disappointing. I know the same situation is true of Swedish in Finland. So this raises the question of motivation. Why do people want to learn languages, or one language in particular? An interesting way forward was pointed out in the form of the Malouf report, which many of you may be familiar with here. And this sets out the choice of languages in terms of, three options, three criteria for the languages that you're going to, can be learned. One, an international language of wider communication, which in many cases will be English. Two, what is called a personal adoptive language, which depends on individual motivation. So here we tie in very nicely with the whole question of motivation for language learning. And three, the language of the state in question. So obviously if you're a Turkish speaker, or arriving in wherever, it will be the language of the state where you're living. This also ties up with another interesting philosophical and legal issue, which we also spent a long time discussing, the tension between the right to speak a language and the duty to speak a language. As part of the integration agenda, because obviously that's got tie-ins with the third option, where you're required to speak the language of the state in question. On a practical front, we were just beginning to discuss the many local initiatives, but we only had time to make the observation that there are no structures and no channels for people to share their experiences, and certainly there's a policy gap here.
Thank you very much. And finally, Terry, who's going to use up most of his time getting up to the front.
Yes, yeah. I had to hide there, so I couldn't.
Yes, I won't. Well, you can dive on why.
Okay, no, I won't waste time on that. Right, so apologies in advance to the group. We had an excellent discussion. We couldn't cover, obviously, the whole range of questions that were there. So we focused really on the nature of policy, what policy is, and probably the obstacles to policy being implemented in ways, the gap between rhetoric and what actually happens. So in terms of, we started by saying, well, what does policy actually mean? We talked about official policy. We talked about the fact that we could talk about measures which are not about languages but other things which impact on what actually happens in real life, contradictory policies, and then, of course, what people actually do in practice. So it's not straightforward just talking about this concept of policy. And that really that is linked to the notion of policy as what people believe it to be. And and the representations around the issues which are addressed by policy. Beliefs about languages, for example, which then determines, again, how policy is developed and implemented. So there's a dynamic relationship between what people are believing, what they're doing, how they're interpreting policy, how policy is being made. And having come up with that, and the fact that actually policy, you can never have an absolute clarity of policy, it led us into the obstacles to a more coherent policy on languages for social cohesion. It was observed that the dynamic for policy change needs very strong support, a kind of basic consensus about what policy might be. And yet people have very strong beliefs about languages, they have very strong beliefs about the communities that use those languages, and about their own language learning, no matter which community they belong to. So all of that, this issue of representations and how we understand perceptions, underpins the obstacles which were identified. And we identified three, really. The first was the issue of terminology and the fact that we talk about languages using different terms, not only in English either. So, you know, in English we talk about world languages, community languages, foreign languages, modern foreign languages, languages, all of those things, and all of which has an impact on how they're perceived. We talked about the power issues between the different types of language, as identified in that way, between the different communities of language users, and the issues around monolingual and multilingual and power issues there. We talked then about how then you can encourage pupils to valorise their outside, out-of-school learning, knowledge, experience, for example, their own languages, and that they tend to kind of count really the languages that they learn in the classroom when they're asked to think about competencies. There's also the issue of what is English in other countries, and English shifting into not being a foreign language, but actually an additional or second language in those countries. So all of that impacts really on the way in which we understand different languages. We talked about teacher supply, how to get trained teachers in a range of languages, and the issues of status that that can lead to, how we can encourage communities themselves to valorise teaching of their languages and to recognise that their languages are something which do have a part to play. And thirdly, about primary, interestingly, because it was felt that although clearly primary language learning was crucial and we needed clarity of aims, we needed it to be something which recognises a range of languages, encourages learners to valorise their own languages. Great opportunities, certainly in the English frameworks for intercultural learning, learning to learn, motivation for lifelong language learning, etc. But there were some concerns expressed about how in practice that actually happens, how it develops, which languages are we talking about. How do we ensure that learners are motivated by that experience rather than turned off? So that was something which, interestingly, was seen as an obstacle. So finally, just to sum up, I would say that all of those obstacles were underpinned by this problem of representation. What is a teacher? What is primary languages? What are languages? And how do they link to identities? And that what we really need is this coherent, cohesive strategy across all types of language, and that it would help if teachers saw themselves as language teachers rather than teachers of English or French or German, where very often there's some kind of infighting there, that we need to be together, really, to promote language teaching. And there was a concern expressed that, in fact, there was very often quite a monoculturalism amongst language teachers, and that we needed to overcome that if we were going to have a common cause.
Thank you very
was that
much.
Only 2 minutes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good.
Yeah, totally 2 minutes. I mean, it's conference time. Right. No, that's wonderful. Thank you all very much. A lot of things there. We will capture that. I mean, they don't know that. They're either going to have to write up very good notes now and give them to either Susie or Yvonne, or you can have time and you can send them down off on your journey back, because we want to get all of this builded up so that we actually have we can actually document what people are saying and then probably resort them a little bit, because there's a lot of overlap there. There might be things you want to add as well. I think we need to, not need to, want to move on. I'm delighted. I said earlier in one of the discussions that it's very important to the conception of this meeting that it's not just language people talking to each other. And I'm delighted that Keith Ajegbo has agreed to speak to us. This is about the only sort of slightly set piece bit in the day, but I don't think it'll be too set piecey. Looking at it from a different perspective, I mean, Keith, you probably know, is a head teacher. He's works for the Citizens Foundation. He does many other things. He's setting up the diploma on humanities, which is a new development in this country. So, a lot of expertise. We've asked him to talk about languages and citizenship from his perspective. Thank you very much, Keith. Oh, let me find yes. Let me put my technician's hat on.
You just move it on that one.
Right. There we are. Yes, or you can do it on the button.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, I'm not a linguist, shamefully. I did French O level and Latin A level, and speak, unfortunately, no other languages. I felt shameful since I've been sitting here all day. My involvement in all of this is that I was a head teacher of an inner city school in Deptford, southeast London, and we did an awful lot of work on citizenship education, became one of the sort of leading, I suppose, schools on citizenship education, not through my work, through the work of people in my school. I just sort of validated it and got the praise. And as a result of that, when the department was looking at the whole aspects of community cohesion, I was asked to lead the writing of a report on diversity and citizenship that came out almost at the same time as the duty to promote community cohesion became part of the English education system. So I've then been thinking about that in relation to the curriculum and to some of the subjects in the curriculum. So just to start off with, I know you've seen this definition, but that was the definition that was in the guidance that was sent out to schools in 2007 around community cohesion. And at first it was out there for a year, then in 2008 Ofsted started statutory to inspect community cohesion in all English schools. And that makes a difference. It makes a difference to how schools see community cohesion. It makes a difference to how head teachers view what they've got to do. And I suppose through this presentation, all I really wanted to do was to question how languages policy fits into all the work that schools are doing around community cohesion. Because in fact, when we were setting it up, and when I've been going to conferences, and when I've been talking about it, in a funny sort of way, it hasn't been languages anywhere at the forefront. We've been talking about RE, we've talked about citizenship, we've talked a lot about history and geography, but not that much, in a sense, about languages. So I think there's a whole lot of work to be done to bring languages even further into this particular debate. At the time, then, in 2006, the review that I was asked to lead, which sort of led into the community cohesion stuff, we were asked two questions. I think it was by Ruth Kelly. It seems a long, long time ago, but I think it was Ruth Kelly who was the Secretary of State at that time. And the two questions, we'll take the second one first. How is ethnic, religious and cultural diversity addressed in the school curriculum? And so that was really looking at the curriculum. We felt this was a curriculum issue and what was done across the curriculum. But the second question, which always evoked much more interest when we were talking to all the people they asked us to talk to, was should British modern social and cultural history be the fourth pillar of citizenship, which is a sort of Britishness question. And we were asked, as three of us writing it, someone from Bert Beck, a teacher from my school, and myself. It was a very small thing. We were invited, rather scarily, to a breakfast by Gordon Brown, and he was in number 11 at the time, to all these sort of famous historians and constitutionalists. And he asked, I remember him saying there, why can't the British feel British in the way that Americans feel American? And clearly this notion of Britishness was very much on the agenda, I think other things have probably taken over since then, but at that point in his thinking was very much on the agenda. And the relationship between a notion of Britishness and a notion of community cohesion was something that we were asked, I suppose, to think about. What we said, for what it's worth, and I think there's quite interesting things about where languages fit. We believe that schools should celebrate difference, that you should celebrate all sorts of difference, linguistic difference, ethnic difference, sexuality, disability. All those things need to be celebrated for children to feel that they belong. But we also felt that at the same time, schools should try to celebrate what brings us together, what are the things that make us a community, and then how does that move outwards from the school community to the local to the national. And I suppose then, where does languages fit on both of those? What part does sharing languages and intercultural dialogue play, both in difference and in also in how we come together? And I think it has to play a part in both, and probably can. I think there are all sorts of ways in which it can. But then I suppose we were asking ourselves a question: why at the end of 2006 was everyone worried about community cohesion? Why did it suddenly come on the agenda and had to be something that was inspected in schools? And you had to feel, you had to believe that at that particular time it was the fear of terrorism and extremism related to it. I mean, that seemed to be the driver. It was just after 7/7. I think Trevor Phillips, who was from the CRE, had said at that time that we were sleepwalking to segregation. From a government point of view, that seemed to be the driver. And one of the big things around community cohesion over the last couple of years has been the prevent agenda, the prevent violent extremism agenda, which is part of the spectrum of community cohesion and has been much contested, I think, by many people. And then, of course, changing patterns of immigration. And the fact that when immigration, I've always seen, ever since the River of Blood speech by Enoch Powell, I think it was 1968, you always see immigration as being about being black or Asian or being of another race or colour. And it hasn't been, has it? In terms of Polish and Eastern European immigration, it's been about language and other sorts of cultural difference. And it's clear, going to a conference led by the Institute of Community Cohesion, there was a graph about the number of people now who could potentially or have voted BNP, voted for a far-right party. And that is clearly something that's happened in the country over the last 5 or 6 years. And there's a hardening, if you read any of the papers these days, it seems to me there's a hardening, more xenophobic attitude by many people towards immigration, which might be that definition of Britishness where people turn inwards. And I think there's a whole issue there. And I think there's some research that's just coming out that's suggesting that there is that and has been that hardening of attitudes towards difference and towards others. But I also think, and I think also this has something to do with how people see themselves, that there has been some evidence. I think Britain came bottom in some league table and UNICEF set out in Europe in terms of happiness, in young people and happiness. And the evidence that was based on that was around teenage gang. There was a whole spate of teenage gang killings. I mean, that seemed to suggest people were looking inwards in little groups. There was a lot of evidence about teenage pregnancies, a lot of evidence about binge drinking and drug taking in English communities. And that might have been evidence, and this is only hypothetical in a sense, that young people starting to look inwards and not looking outwards. Young people, the gang stuff is about looking inwards, to making yourself ever more parochial and much less global. And in the face of the complexity of multiple identities, which we talk about, sometimes there's a bit of a cliche about multiple identities. What does it really mean? In the complexity of young people's lives, where the world around them seems to become ever more complex, perhaps you want something simple, and you want to look inwards to your sort of local group of mates, with all the issues that can sometimes breed in terms of gangs and the things that can happen. And, of course, what the papers call the underclass of young people. And all the money that has been poured into education over the last 10, 12 years hasn't eased the gap between young people on free school meals and young people not on free school meals in terms of achievement. And there's still all those restrictions in terms of the sort of the monolingual population, all those restrictions that come through being poor and the relationship between poverty and underachievement, which I think is a community cohesion issue in terms of how those people live and behave in their communities. And also, stuff that you know, the obvious stuff. I went onto a whole lot of conferences to introduce the duty to promote community cohesion with Ted Cantle, who was the person who wrote the report on the Bradford riots back in 2001. And he used these statistics. They're his statistics. Also told a joke about the British woman who went to live in Spain because she wanted to avoid foreigners. But but the number of people, the whole changing world, the fact that languages are everywhere, or is it that English is everywhere? But the changing world in which people are moving around, will continue to move around, and the massive amount of an influx of immigration into this country over the last 10 years that has made a difference to communities and that have been sometimes quite difficult to manage to live with. And also that all those issues around tourism, globalisation, and the internet, and how they make all those things must make a difference. Profound difference to how young people see the world that they live in and how young people deal with that world. And although, in a sense, that should mean that languages are everywhere, we become more mixed up. That is evidence in British education that languages have moved away from being at the centre and less pupils are studying them than used to be the case. That's partly policy. But also I think it's to do with the things that they're pushed to and possibly interested in. So all of these strands in British education, the whole movement towards the Department for Children, Schools and Families, the whole move to ECM and Every Child Matters, away from standards on the one hand, moving just from a standards-dominated agenda to one that is holistic, that takes in the whole child. What part in all of that development of education over the last 10 years, what part has a school's languages policy played in that? What is the relationship? And I'm not sure that I understand it, nor am I sure that as a head I understood it. What is the relationship between a school's language policy and the notion that every child matters? Has every child matters been about their particular language? Or has every child matters been about the way in which that child learns English and that child ensuring that they can get above a C in GCSE in English? I think there's a big question there and something that needs... What does personalised learning mean in terms of children's languages and children's identity? And I think there's a whole series of things around the big policy issues around personalised learning, extended schooling, the introduction of community cohesion, about the part that languages and language identity has played. And I think that needs to be looked at and thought about in a bit more detail. And in my view, and this is perhaps a limited view, that languages has possibly and is still an academic subject in the English secondary education for the few, and perhaps has become more so over the last 10 years. And so... community cohesion. In terms of the whole duty to promote community cohesion, the first question, I suppose, that schools have to ask themselves is what is the community you're talking about and trying to define that community. Is the school community just the children and the teachers and the support staff within the school gates? Is that the school community? Is that the community you're trying to make cohesive? Is it the community in which the school is located? You know, a mile radius around the school, are those the people you're trying to make? Or children coming from different language, ethnic backgrounds, how you might bring those together? Is that part of your community brief? Is there a duty on schools in terms of community cohesion, as Gordon Brown would suggest, to think about, if not Britishness, at least national identity? What is the relationship between local and national identity? What is the school's responsibility to fostering a sense of national identity? And then, of course, when we started on this and talked about Britishness, but people would say to us, but they're global citizens. It's a global world. What is then is the relationship between your identity, your local identity, your national identity? Does anyone in England or Britain ever think of themselves as European? I mean, some do, I suppose, but what about European identity in that? A lot of children don't see themselves as European and wouldn't understand a European identity. And how do you move from a European identity to some sense when you've got things like Copenhagen? How do they move to some notion of being part of the world? And it almost seems to me that the school curriculum should be based around that journey. How you move from your local identity to becoming a global citizen picks up an awful lot of stuff around the school curriculum. But what part and in what languages do you learn and what part has language teaching played in taking children on that journey? And to what extent has it been thought through? And I was just thinking, when we were discussing in the group, are the languages for employability? Are the languages for identity? And are the languages for community cohesion? And are they different sorts of languages? And in what sequence do they come? And how do schools create their policy around those different things? And I think there's a lot of questions there about the status of languages and which languages have status. And then I was trying to think for myself and looking stuff up about why do we bother anyway? What is the reason? What are the motivations for children to learn languages? And some of the things that I picked up that I think are important. It does broaden your awareness of others. I mean, learning a different language. I mean, these are things you know and I've been thinking about as a head teacher, perhaps not having taken these on board sufficiently, and perhaps other head teachers as well. The notion of viewing the mother culture through the eyes of the target culture can be an enlightening experience in terms of empathy, in terms of putting yourself in a slightly different position. And I think the next one, part of the reason for having a second or foreign languages or a number of languages in the curriculum, is the signal which the provision sends regarding the room which a school visibly makes for the study of other cultures. It is a statement about what you believe about pluralism, I think, in terms of what languages you have. And as a school with 33 languages spoken, I regret to say that as a head teacher, and I was certainly not alone, the only language that we taught officially was French. And I'm sure that still happens in lots and lots of schools. And also the whole thing about confronting other cultures, understanding the arrogance of one, all of those things, and ignorance of difference, I think are important about languages teaching and need to be brought more into the debate about community cohesion and how we live together. And then the big themes of cohesion. The big themes are things that when the inspectors, the Ofsted inspectors, go into schools, the three things that they're going to look at, very specifically, because initially when community cohesion came out, schools would use anything. You know, I've got a black kid playing in the football team. That must mean we're a cohesive community. They wanted to tie it down and look very much more specifically. So religion and non-religion, ethnicity and culture, socioeconomic status. And these are difficult things. Teaching religion in schools, which is a bit more than just suggesting that in a particular marriage ceremony, such and such. Things about religion and belief and understanding the ways in which different people believe and the way in which they live together, I think is complex. Ethnicity and culture and all those issues around race are complex, as is talking in schools about class. I mean, in order to be able to deal with these things, schools need to be able to deal with controversy and controversial issues. And some of it has been quite difficult, I think, for schools to take on. But in terms of languages, I was just trying to think in terms of languages where these particularly might play out. Aspects of religious dividers. And I went to a conference, I think it was by the Three Faiths Forum, where they were doing work where they were comparing the texts of the great religions in translation and finding that these texts had remarkable similarities. If you looked at the language, it would look massively different. If you looked at the way in which the language was packaged, it would look different. If you got into the language and translated the text, then that wouldn't be the case. You'd see remarkable similarities. And so the notion that the language might be strange, but the sentiment might not, might be ways of bringing some things together and getting children to think perhaps differently about these religions that they might see as divisive. And then in terms of socioeconomic status, the whole thing about learning languages being a middle-class thing, I think is massive. I mean, whenever I see someone who's bringing up their children in French and they're bicultural, that's wonderful. We had hundreds of children at Deptford Green over all the 20 years that I was there that were either bilingual in terms of Cantonese and English, part Gujarat, a whole range of different languages, some of them not achieving that well academically. And I don't think we ever sufficiently celebrated their bilingualism. That it was seen that they had to learn English in order to get their C at GCSE. And we put them in for their heritage language exam, because you could add that to your 5A, 5 plus A to C GCSEs, which push you up the league tables. And I think that is an issue that needs to be looked at. And also the whole thing about languages, the way in which learning a language can divide us, but also the language of class divides us. I mean, so working class and middle class and the ways in which we speak, all of those things. And I think there's a whole big thing there that could be explored much more through language education and putting language education into the bigger picture. And I'm sure that it is done in some places and that some schools do this absolutely brilliantly. But there's also areas where it doesn't happen. And then the things that they're looking at in terms of the Ofsted inspection are three things: teaching, learning and the curriculum, equity and excellence, and extended services and engagement. And very briefly, and I will be brief because it's warm in here and it's after lunch, but the first one was teaching, learning and the curriculum, which is an aspect of the Ofsted inspection. And there was a survey by the Development Education Authority recently, a Development Education Agency, DEA, recently, looking at the attitudes of students, secondary students in schools to difference, to ethnic, cultural difference. And it was quite a big survey done by Ipsos Mori, so it was a legitimate survey. 76% of black students and 66% of Asian students were positive about different kinds of people living together in this country and felt that it was a good thing. Only 47% of white students were. And I think there is an issue here. And recent, if you read the papers, as I said, articles on immigration suggest a hardening of attitudes against difference beneath the surface. And the one thing that I felt very much when we were doing this work on diversity and citizenship is that it is so, even in a small country like England, it is so contextual. London is so different from Bradford, that is so different from Wiltshire, that's so different from Cornwall in terms of the attitudes that people have. And when we were talking to students, they had very clear perspectives on how people saw them. The first two were a couple of kids in Newham. And it was just after that incident in Newham, I think, where two brothers were arrested for terrorist activities and then released. It was back at that. We happened to be in the school that week. And the first Asian boy said, they see Africa as poor, Asia as flooded, and England as snobby whites and poor blacks. And I think there is this issue about glass ceilings for young people in London schools still. Not many people actually, in terms of their results, massively break out of their glass ceilings, because the hierarchy of languages is also related to the hierarchy of how they might see themselves. And I think there is an issue there. The next boy, and this is the one about parochialism, about shutting yourself in as your life becomes more complicated, massively sort of sophisticated, multi-identity, diasporan person, says, I'm black. I live in London. That's my home. My parents are from the Caribbean, but I'm really African. I'm a Christian. He said all this quite slowly, lying back in his chair. He was articulate, thinking slowly about who he was. And then he got quite excited and said, but I'm E7, which is Newham. I'm E7. Look out the window. You're not quite sure why he was quite so excited. But I'm E7. That's where I hang. They're my people. That's who I am. And in a funny sort of way, that's fine to have a group of friends, but it was in E7 that the first of those gang killings, Newham had a lot of those teenagers where you crossed over from E7 into E8, you're in the wrong territory. And that just seemed to me that is incredibly parochial. It's making yourself much, much smaller than you should be. You should be embracing, in this globalised world that we live in, something much wider than that. And what role does languages teaching play in making people feel that they're world citizens? If you're learning French as an academic language and you don't like it that much, does it help? What else could you do? What else can schools do to engender some sense of enthusiasm that there are languages and worlds other than the one that you actually live in? And I think there is a really big issue there. And there were challenges. I mean, when we wrote the report in 2007, issues of race and identity actually weren't as high on schools' agendas as you might imagine they should be. Lots of schools were fairly unsophisticated in dealing with these issues of identity and therefore would not have related a language policy to this sort of things. Languages would be an academic subject. And the head made a fantastic difference. The head of a school and the leadership team of the school made an absolute difference. And it's at that level that it seemed to us that difference happens. And I think that in moving this agenda on since 2007, and it has moved on, the duty to promote community cohesion has made schools take it seriously because they are being inspected. Inspection makes a difference. I don't think that languages policy has been at the forefront of the debate. And at the same time, there has been some decline in languages. And I know that the school that I was head in, although we did have only French, when I left as head and they took French and they made French optional, it almost disappeared very, very quickly. Within 3 years of going, very few pupils are now doing French in the school. And that we weren't alone in that. It's quite difficult to get a GCSE in French. And as Michael Gove will tell you, it's very easy to get one in media studies. I'm not so sure that's the case. And the challenges. And we felt when we wrote the report, only 36% of teachers felt well equipped to teach in multicultural schools. There was a survey by the TDA after teachers came out of teacher training, and 36% felt that they could teach in multicultural schools. And I often then think about the relationship between being a languages teacher and teaching in a multicultural school, because people don't often think of languages teachers as being the agents of multiculturalism. I don't think that they're often at the forefront of multiculturalism in schools. Quite often languages teachers are heads of French departments or heads of modern foreign languages departments. They don't often or always take in all the other languages and take on this multicultural dimension. And you would have thought that languages teachers would be most naturally equipped to teach in multicultural schools because of the depth of their cultural immersion. I mean, presumably in learning another language, if it means that you understand another culture, you should be taking that on and spreading that. And I'm not sure, in my view, that languages departments have been at the forefront of that. And that, therefore, our school is going to be able to take advantage of the freedom to teach a wide range of languages. I mean, I've seen some examples in Enfield, in primary schools, speaking, getting the children to learn Greek and Turkish because they're the main languages in those communities. But how often has that happened? How successful has that been? And I think there is more work to be done there. And then, very briefly, the challenges across the community, the curriculum. In Key Stage 3, certainly, there's been an opening up of the curriculum for people to look at the ways in which they might make connections. What are the connections made within the curriculum between teaching languages and teaching geography, or teaching languages and citizenship, and the relationship between understanding languages and being a citizen? And I think there are other possibilities. Now, there is good work. There is good work around the country. But across the system, I think there's much more work that could still be done to open up some of these questions and place languages much more at the centre of overall school policy. To move on quickly, we started off our report on diversity and citizenship, started off with citizenship. That's where it was placed. And what is the relationship, I think, between citizenship and languages education? Citizenship is about pupil voice. Languages is about having a voice. And how has that relationship been teased out in schools? And what is the relationship between languages and this whole journey from local to global citizenship? And how has that been? And so the relationship between languages and a pupil voice in schools, given that a pupil voice is something that has developed considerably over the last few years. And what we suggested in our report was that there should be a fourth strand of citizenship. Citizenship has three strands: moral and social responsibility, political literacy, and community. And we suggested that the fourth strand should be identity and diversity, living together in the UK. But how might this fourth strand also embrace languages? It was meant to be about Britishness. It's meant to be about living together. And the rationale for it was that community cohesion and national identity can come through and around those values that Britain has committed itself to. Not that Britain invented, but that Britain has committed itself to. And that, you know, you can go through the list, respect for the law, political structures, those things. And we felt that these should be subject to discussion and debate in the light of modern British history, because different histories will see these values very differently in the terms of what's happened to them. If you're Jewish, if you're Irish, if you're African Caribbean, if you're Ugandan Asian, your version of British history and its values might be slightly different. And If you look, for instance, the UK as a multinational state, in discussing languages, why do people still want to speak Welsh? Why is Welsh language so important to Welsh identity in terms of Britain as a multinational state? To what extent do we explore the way in which the country comes together? The legacy of empire, the relationship between English and other languages, that was clearly something that happened as Britain spread outward, so did the language. What has happened to the languages of those communities? What is the relationship in terms of the Commonwealth between English and the languages of those other countries? The European Union, the extent to which we're part of the European Union, the extent to which we should be learning European languages to be part of that community, and the extent to which when people come to England, they have to learn English. And that's very important, but how is that related to and the languages that they already have? And we felt there were lots of issues there that had exciting curriculum possibilities that could be exploited, but that language could be part of, and understanding languages could be part of. And finally, the second aspect of the inspection was equity and excellence. So when Ofsted goes in, English schools have massive amount of data. They look at the data. How are your African Caribbean boys doing? How are your white British girls in relation to your small group of Indian children or your Nigerians? All that data is there and can be collated. African Caribbean students underachieve in our academic system. Black boys are three times more likely to be excluded from school. That's 2008. All the time I was in education, that has been an issue for English education. They're 0.3 as likely to be included in gifted and talented cohorts. Worst underachievement, however, at this moment in time, in terms of those league tables by ethnicity and culture, is white working class boys. And they seem to be falling behind rapidly and seem less engaged in the systems. The likelihood, and I haven't got any research on this or any statistics, the likelihood in our system is that both groups will not have progressed far with languages. I think I could almost assume that if you looked at the GCSEs they've taken, not many of those pupils will have a good grade in any language or be that interested in language. And it's a point that's been repeated endlessly, that the acquisition of languages opens up the world for some while closing it for others, and it's often just determined by social class. And I'm not sure that that's changed. I'm not sure that we're in the process of getting to that and really changing it. And the third aspect of engagement of the inspection was engagement and extended services. Schools are expected to be, in the children's plan, it might change with the Tories, in the children's plan, they're meant to be at the hub of their community. And all schools will become extended schools offering services to their community. And where in that is language learning and intercultural dialogue in terms of these opportunities for community engagement? I've seen schools that do it. One school that I went to a conference where two schools had brought the Somali community absolutely into the school and opened up the school to the Somalian culture. And as a result of that, the school had become interested in it, involved in it. Other parents had become interested, involved. And the achievement of Somalian pupils and the behaviour of Somalian pupils had massively improved. But that seemed to be a relatively rare example. And quite often extended schooling was just about having more after-school classes. So that's another area, I think, for development where languages can play a part. And just to finish, I went to, because I was doing the humanities diploma, which wasn't that popular, I think, with the opposition, there was a recent document by Reform. I think Reform is a think tank, should be Reform with a capital R. And this piece of was endorsed by Michael Gove. He was at the conference. He was there endorsing the stuff that the think tank had written as a shadow minister for education. And in a sense, it sounded like he was putting languages very much back in the core, because in the Reform think tank, they were saying that schools should now do, based on research in, I think, Singapore, South Korea, Canada and Finland, that schools should go back to five core academic GCSEs, of which you should have English, you should have maths, you should have a science, a humanities, and very much a language. So language would go back in there, if this was what they were going to do, as one of the core academic compulsory GCSEs. It should be about knowledge transfer, it's not about applied learning, it's not about vocational learning. The countries with the best record go back to that traditional definition of knowledge transfer via traditional GCSE academic subjects. But that's fine, I suppose, on one level for languages teaching, because everyone will go back to doing a language, or that would be the intention. But surely more should be done to see languages applied in the real world and connected to a more holistic view of ourselves and our identities. And I got no sense that what they were suggesting would mean that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Keith. That was frustrating, actually, in a sense. It was wonderful to listen to, but we kept thinking there, now we've got to have questions now, but we can't. So hold your questions. We will try and carve out some time at the end for anything you want to discuss or ask about, but I think it's probably better if we move on. Could we do a little bit of rearranging of the furniture, actually the people sitting on the furniture, because I'm looking at David and Mike in particular, and Kate, because it would be quite... Rather than having this table here, which is rather uncomfortable, if the three people in the panel could come and sit on the corners here and you could kind of budge up a bit or some other thing. So if Dina and... or Mike is... You've got to switch round, just got to switch round, haven't you? And Hans is somewhere. Could you come up here? That'd be easier to handle. Sorry? Yeah, when they come to speak, but what we do is to put them on the chair for you and get them up here when you want
to
do your thing. So who's going first?
Dina.
Right, we're gonna move straight on now to the last of the main sessions. I'm Simon Glendinning. I'm the reader in European philosophy in the European Institute. Very interested in the themes that you're talking about, and share something rather awful with Sir Keith, which is he mentioned a certain shame, literally a shame, regarding his own monolingualism, and I confess I'm one of those as well. And in a way, all the talk of multilingualism, I think, is best conceived through questions of moving beyond monolingualism rather than simply in terms of an aspiration to multilinguism. I think the urgency would be to think of moving beyond monolingualism. And I think the multilingualism policy of the European Union of 2+1 is a wonderful aspiration with respect to this. But I think everybody knows that it's an aspiration, that it's a certain kind of very, very distant goal. If European Union was made up of states in which each one had its own language and everybody in each one spoke the same language, and that everybody was going to have this aspiration to speak two of the other languages of Europe plus their own, if it was all like that, then perhaps it would be... merely the limitations of teachers and provision which would prevent the 2+1 becoming a kind of reality. We Europeans, we would be not one, but we would be 2+1. But that's not real. Globalization of a certain English, not just a culturally American English, but of a certain machine code English, means that that kind of aspiration is already interrupted. The globalization of the world, of a worldwideization of our world, people moving around, delocalizations, decolonizations of peoples, families, of lovers, friends, and so on. It means that on the one side we'd have a virtually enforced polylingualism for some, and equally a virtually enforced monolingualism for others. So the movement today beyond monolingualism has also to be, for us, for those working within the European Union, has to be a movement both beyond a certain Eurocentrism and also a movement beyond a kind of anti-Eurocentrism. Sir Keith's point, very well taken, that we need to celebrate differences and our singularities, but equally a duty to celebrate possibilities of our alliances of singularities made possible here. in this European space where we want to cultivate singularity and we want to cultivate equality. Now, this is in Europe, I say, but perhaps most sharply in European cities. London, great European city, and hence, therefore, also a great world city, always more than merely European. And today's talks, this afternoon's talks, are going to be about these cities. We've got speakers from a number of cities, from at least naming cities here in London, Utrecht and Sheffield. Each speaker has a little bit of time, and then after that, a little bit more time for us to talk with each other. And first, we're going to have Dina Mehmedbegovic, who's from the Institute of Education in London, who's going to speak to you first. Okay, hand over. Thank you.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I'd just like to say, first of all, that I'm very honoured to be invited here to speak to you about London, and thank you, Lyd and Nick, for inviting me. This morning I cycled through Frosted Hyde Park and looked at the sunrise and snowflakes, and it was very inspiring to do that on the way here and to prepare for this talk. I've been a Londoner for more than 17 years, and throughout my life and career here, I've been involved with bilingual and multilingual communities. I've worked with bilingual communities through the Refugee Council's programs, helping them settle in this country, and then I started working in education in private schools and then in Camden School, and I also worked as an ethnic minority achievement advisor in really the heart of London and city of Westminster. And currently I work for London Education Research Unit, and we focus on key London issues. So really my aim is to try and provide some snapshots for you, because there's so much to be said about multilingualism in London that my aim is really my ambition just to provide you with some snapshots and hopefully give you some insights. I'm acknowledging here that I'll be using maps and data provided by an ESRC-funded study that was led by IOE, and we also had a user fellow from Newham working with us. And this really happened as an initiative right at the start when London Education Research Unit was established in 2007 to say, well, languages are really a key issue for London, and we want to be doing research that will contribute to updating the study called Multilingual Capital that was published in the year 2000. I'll be also drawing on research that I've contributed to in preparation for the development of the national EAL strategy. EAL stands for English as an Additional Language, and also my own research studies that I've conducted with bilingual families, bilingual students, London head teachers, and also politicians and policymakers. Okay, I just would like to start by visiting the national data first. This is the data available from the Department for Children, Schools and Families. And the latest data is that we've got 15% to children in primary schools who are speakers of other languages, and in secondary schools this drops down to 11.1. I personally find this drop very puzzling, because from my experience in London schools, we know that there's a kind of high influx of children from other countries, and also in secondary schools we receive more unaccompanied minors from countries in conflict. So the expectation would be, for me personally, that this is quite the other way around, that there are more bilingual children in secondary schools. And I think the questions need to be asked whether this drop is to do with, I don't know, possible immigration, or maybe children leaving state schools, going into independent schools, or perhaps with the fact that children lose their first language and stop identifying as bilinguals, or simply they deny their own bilingualism for some reason. From the research that we've conducted for the Yale National Strategy, regional advisors have actually reported that there are lots of cases of children denying their own bilingualism in secondary schools. in big urban centres. And their own explanation of that was that it was often to do with racism or different types of discrimination. In Westminster schools, I have come across this myself, and kind of when in discussion with teachers, I was told that the view was that children just want to fit in and be like the others. Well, I will now show you that this is kind of the picture of London comparative to other regions. And as you can see, it's well over 40% of total school population in London who are bilingual. So really, the argument is that the others are increasingly also bilingual or multilingual. So this argument that children are trying to be like the others really doesn't fit this picture in London. Also, just to say that the figures provided by London Challenge for inner London schools are that over 50%, 52% of children are actually bilingual. Just thinking about this issue of underreporting and a denial of bilingualism, there was a study conducted by Jan Bloemert in Belgium classrooms where he came across similar occurrences, and his kind of argument is that in school practices which are underpinned by monoglot ideologies, it's communicated to children that the only affirmed linguistic profile is the profile of the monolingual speaker of the dominant language. So this is very much where I kind of position my research in trying to explain why this happens. As I said before, the research that we conducted, funded by ESRC, it's very much aiming to produce material that will contribute to the updating multilingual capital study, which has been really the Bible in terms of referring to and studying languages in London. And this study was published in 2000, so it's nearly 10 years on. And we are now collecting data, actually data has been collected already, where we're trying also to compare what's kind of happened to linguistic diversity in London in the last 9 or 10 years. And you can see here that, first of all, the population of school population in London has increased, but what we have here is kind of decrease in categories of languages which are collected. Now, there is data missing in this research, so because some local authorities were not collecting data in the way that was required for this project, or data simply wasn't collected at that level. So there is some data missing, and probably the fact that the number of languages decreased is something to do with that. There's also this whole issue of the kind of parallel world of independent schools, international schools, and schools that are supported by the governments of other countries, which also practice bilingual teaching. For example, London International School Association has 16 schools registered just in London, and these schools have between 1,000 and 300 children on their register. So there's at least another 20,000 bilingual children in London area. Okay, this is really just an illustration of kind of maps that will be available for the multilingual capital update that we're preparing. And I'd like to say that we're working in partnership with SILT. This study is going to be published by SILT. So these are kind of the maps that will be available in that publication. This particular one looks at different concentration of EAL pupils in London. And this one is looking at the opposite picture of pupils whose first language is English or believed to be English. Okay. Okay. Also, we'll be focusing on certain languages that are very high up on the list in terms of the number of speakers in London, and Bengali is one of the languages that features at the top of the list in London. And the kind of level of detail we'll be providing are number of speakers, and you can see here it's over 46,000 speakers registered in London schools, again, state schools, and for people who know London well, they will know that kind of main concentration is in Tower Hamlets and then spreading to Newham, Redbridge, some in little clusters in Hillingdon, in Enfield and in Southwark. Okay. Yeah, this is very much what I was talking about. In Tower Hamlets, there's 43% of all children in London who speak Bengali. Some other data provided by Greater London Authority gives figure that one-third of the adult population speak Bengali in Tower Hamlets. While I was doing my research in Westminster, Bengali-speaking children were also one of our kind of greater minority groups, and we had over 11% of school population in Westminster speaking Bengali. So I'm going to provide you some insights that I've gained in research with Bengali-speaking students. But before I do that, I just would like to acknowledge that in London there are pockets of excellent practice, and SILT website provides a very rich database of good practice in mainstream schools, not only in London, but nationally. And I've just selected few examples that I personally really like. This first school teaches geography through the medium of other languages. And what is really excellent about that is that they were hoping to increase their results in these other languages they use as the medium of teaching. But what happened was they also increased results in geography. So this really shows that another language is not only a linguistic and cultural resource, but also a cognitive resource. And with my from my interview with the head teacher who did the same thing in his primary school, he also said he basically asked all teachers to use French for some parts of their curriculum, and he said that results increased across the curriculum. And the way he explained that was he said that basically teachers had to prepare much better for their lessons because they were also new to using another language in their curriculum. They had to focus much more on exploring key concepts, which again is a good practice for everybody, monolingual, bilingual students, and this really showed in terms of a better attainment for everybody. Newbury Park School in Redbridge, they've been recognised on the European level. They won an award in 2005, and they developed the initiative called Language of the Month. Very simple. They have a template where they record a child or a parent saying hello, saying how are you, basic things about the country where they come from. And then everybody uses that video clip in their classrooms, all teachers, to kind of learn a few basic words of this other language and to learn something about another country, another culture. And again, there were outcomes of this initiative that was not something they were looking for right at the beginning, like the relationship with parents improved a lot because they had parents coming in work on this initiative with children. Parents who didn't speak English, who for the first time came to school, did that through this project. And really, if you're talking about social cohesion, it's kind of a really good model of what can be achieved through a simple initiative like that. From my recent communication with the school, they've told me that they've covered all the languages the children speak, and that's more than 40 languages in their school. And children are so enthusiastic about this initiative and learning other languages, they're thinking of doing other world languages and doing Latin as well. So these examples are truly, truly inspiring. Our languages project, Sarah already talked about that, big initiative, lots of funding, but unfortunately it has come to an end, but at least that there is a toolkit, and we can hope that schools will use that to continue these good practices. Also, I would like not to forget the international schools. Kind of maintenance of native languages, mother tongue languages, is appearing more and more in terms of the ethos and policies of these schools. And when you look at this school in Egham, they say they've got speakers of 24 languages. Well, almost any community school in London has, you know, greater linguistic variety, diversity. But it's really excellent to see that they've got it on their website as part of their mission, that they're encouraging all students to maintain their native language proficiency, acknowledging that this actually helps their acquisition of additional languages, and they provide something that they refer to as native language enrichment programs. Again, I'm flagging this up because I think that we do have a skewed picture about multilingualism in London or in any other context if we just focus on state schools and don't acknowledge that lots of elite bilinguals are being very focused on developing their bilingual skills. Okay, this is really what I call young voices, a child reflecting on how his parents feel about the fact that they're changed by the system if they lose minority languages. And he was also saying he was in a school, in Pimlico School, where they had Bengali as a GCSE course, but he was saying that it would have been much better if lessons were available from year 7 and that parents would feel happier about their children going to school and they wouldn't take them for such long holidays. This child addresses really several key cause and effect issues in terms of alienation that's caused in families through language loss, also issue of absence of first language provision in mainstream schools resulting in these long holidays. And as I identified by Ofsted, long-term absence is one of the main reasons of underachievement of Bangladeshi pupils, and they are amongst the three top groups in terms of underachievement nationally. This is a politician commenting on a statement by a child. And I use this statement because it's a very extreme statement saying Bengali has no value. And for a child who speaks Bengali to speak like that, I think, you know, it makes lots of people really sad and shocked to read that. You know, I was really using this statement expecting that people I interview will say, well, no child should feel like that in our system. Why is that? But this interviewed a Conservative MP. Of course, he's anonymous here, and all the interviewers had the options of doing that. But he had no hesitation in saying, yes, the student is right, Bengali has no value. And what you can see here is that there are competing discourses of our culture and our economy, where our culture is defined in a very narrow way, only in terms of heritage languages, whereas our economy is liberated from this national framework. It's kind of looking towards growth in international markets, and therefore languages will be recognized as valuable if they can play a part in that. Just to say, I also had a letter from Malcolm Rifkind, who was too busy to give me an interview, but he offered to do a letter, and he said I could attribute his contribution in my writing and in my research. So I would just read you key points of what he sees, in his view, important for the government policy on bilingualism. He says, all persons who settle in this country or born here should have English as their first language. Really important that he sees that as first language. Therefore, this should be a priority of government policy. As far as bilingualism is concerned, attention needs to be paid to Welsh and Gaelic. There's the risk that these languages will die out, which would be damaging for the culture in Scotland and Wales. Regarding bilingualism involving languages spoken in other parts of the world, these considerations don't apply. And therefore, there is no need for government policy to support these families in these languages. it then becomes a cultural, a personal matter for families concerned. So you can see that this kind of conservative view is very consistent amongst a very small sample of politicians I interviewed. I will finish by kind of reflecting on changing practice. I'm often asked when I go to schools to do insights for teachers or to work with schools on developing their policy to do with ethnic minority achievement or bilingualism to kind of provide recommendations. And recently I was asked to participate, to contribute a chapter to a book called Education in a Global City, which is about London, and again to give recommendations. So one of the recommendations that I'm advocating is that we need simple steps that teachers who are monolingual themselves and have been educated and working in monolingual context will not feel, scared of and out of their depth when you start discussing with them. So what I'm suggesting as a first very small step is that we try and use opportunities that we have in schools to communicate these affirmative messages to do with languages as a resource. And I kind of see a really good link between Healthy School Initiative and using every opportunity to talk to children about healthy lifestyles and healthy diet and eating five items of fruit and vegetable a day. And I'm saying that in the same way we should be finding spaces to talk to children about healthy linguistic diet and just acknowledging that we are aware they're going to a complementary school to say, have you done your homework in two languages? Have you spoken to somebody in your language? Just really using these little opportunities that don't take any planning or particular, national curriculum time to do that. And the idea for this I had while I was doing a focus discussion group, again with Bengali students, when we were discussing why they're underachieved. And one of them said, Miss, we underachieve because we speak two languages. And his friend said, no, I read in a scientific journal that it's good for your brain. And I really felt terrible, as a teacher. I thought I was doing everything I could to support children in doing their work bilingually, presenting bilingually, doing discussions bilingually. But I felt guilty myself that I never really sat down with them to talk about what it means to be bilingual, whether that's good for us or not, what kind of benefits there are in being bilingual. And this is really when I realized that there needs to be space and time to really discuss this with children and just highlight that even in this particular moment of time and in this context, even if Bengali has no value economically, that there are cognitive values in handling another language and working in two languages, and this is something that children and parents need to be aware of. Okay, thank you very much.
Right, well done. Thank you very much for sticking to time. Moving on, Hans Sackers now from Utrecht. Are you using a PowerPoint?
There is something in it.
There is something here. Is it in here? Here we are, this one. Okay, you should be able to use the buttons just up and down.
This was the biggest tower in the Netherlands for a very long time.
And you don't want to sleep here.
Well, it's noisy.
Every quarter of an hour.
Not mine. So, hello. Also start with thank you for inviting me, because it's helping me a lot to formulate the ideas we're working on and to we're just beginning and to know where it's about. And well, we're with the state of art in our little town. We are coming from a provincial town. Well, at least it was until 2000 we were 230,000 inhabitants, and now we 320,000 inhabitants. We've grown to 450 in the coming 15 years. So we're one of the special places in Europe that is really growing. Most of the cities in Europe are declining, but we are one of the centers where something is going on. I'm working for the city. I'm the head of a department. It's called public, well, it's in Dutch, it's Bestuurlijke Internationale en Subsidiezaken. And this is in fact the central strategy department for the mayor and the board of vice mayors. So, and one of the things we're doing is relating the city to the rest of the world. We have an office in Brussels, an office in The Hague to connect with the ministries with the and the European programs. And what I'm going to do is that I will introduce shortly the city, because it's giving an image of why we are interested in this issue. I will tell you something about how we start 3 years ago. I will tell you something about the research we have done last year, and where are we now, and what will we do in 2010. Well, this city is not so well known, but it's in fact you can see it as a twin city with Amsterdam, but well, only 50% of the size and without the tourists. It has the same profile with very high educated population. 60% has a higher education. It's one of the most rich parts of Europe. It's you can compare it with regions like Munich as what's coming in on in the economic in the economic world. We have a lot of students. It's a very young city. So it's the youngest city in the Netherlands because everyone wants to study there. And we have a tradition of cosmopolitan thinking, and we never had a conservative city government. And now you see that that also made that we have diversity policy. And but now, the last year, we get some influence of the nationalistic debate also. And I will tell you some more about how it works when I try to the European policy of trilinguality to our mayor and vice mayor, how they have to tell the story. It's also the first reaction is, of course, Dutch first. But also still learning Dutch. Yes, yes, sir. Well, that kind of nervosity is all also in our. This is an interesting picture because we did a referendum in 2005. And we were the only city in the Netherlands that voted in favor of the constitution. And that was for us a symbol. We have been using it a lot to tell the story about it, that we have a very special city. This is the elections of the new parliament in 2009. And I giving you this story because it's not really about language, but these two red spots that are our that are the districts where the extreme right party was the biggest. So we don't have a real right-wing atmosphere in the city, but we still have 8% of the voters that are interested in voting this kind of parties. And it's very different from The Hague or Rotterdam, where this kind of party has 25-30%. So we have local elections in March this year, coming year. And so we have a very important cooperation with the four big cities, and we're doing everything together. And what will happen after these elections will be very... well, we have to wait on that, if we can go on with four cities. And this is the first slide as introduction to what the research we did, because this is about the number of languages people speaking in average per district. And you see here that there is this is 2.5 language. A person is 3. This is the average in some of our districts. And but the two districts that on the bottom are exactly the same districts that are voting right wing. And we found another significant relation between the number of languages in that direction and the ethnic tolerance. And it was asked in the question, do you accept that your child would marry with someone from another ethnic group, that you see that there is a very direct relation until 5 languages, and then it's stopping that influence. Well, this is not only because the white labor class is living in these areas, also because the minorities, or how you call them, are living in these areas. because the same kind of racism, ethnic intolerance are also in this group, and they're related with the number of languages, at least. Not that there is a very well-known relation, but there is a relation. Well, I start now. This was the introduction. In 2005-6, we were reading this European research about national levels of multilingualism. And then you have Malta, Luxembourg, the Netherlands. That's the top three, I think. And so we asked ourselves, what is our local position in relation to the national position? And we did the first survey, and we found out that it was much better than the Netherlands, and really much better. And we started to tell about it. And the first reaction of the politicians was, well, what is this about? Stupid idea. Why did you do this kind of research? This is not on the political agenda. And we kept on talking about it and distributing these numbers, because 77% in that first survey was of the people in our city was speaking three languages or more. And we know that is very much very high percentage. And slowly they started to become interested. There was one of our vice mayors was a member of the committee of the region, and he had to do to make a report about multilingualism, or he had to react on it at least. And now I have two or three fighting deputy mayors in this thing. And say everything, there is organized something. And I say, I want to do that. I want to do the opening. And I want to... So that's a good thing. But we didn't put it on the political agenda on the council level, because my feeling, it's too early. So my strategy is more to let it grow, to spread around, to do projects, and to do it bottom-up. And because the political climate is so sensitive that it's too early. And say we'll take it in the national debate, and it will be a nationalistic discourse about what is good, what is wrong, what is, and instead of looking for opportunities. I will tell you now a little bit about the research we did. We did every year we are doing a big survey on the whole population. And so we know now about the level of the language I used in the city in relation to a lot of background characteristics of the same people. So we know about the way they're using it, words they're using it, etc. So also ethnic intolerance or whatever cultural participation we can relate to the number and the sort of languages. This is, you see, when we are, when you ask them, like European Union did, for can you have a little conversation in that language, this is the answer, that 5% say, I can only do it in one language, 15% say, I can do it in two, or 10, and the rest say, well, I can do something in another language. And even 85% say... Well, you can say, what's the level of this? We asked, can you do it well? And then still, you have almost 60% of the people that say that they're speaking three languages or more. Well, that is on the European level, this is a lot. It's related in the city. It's that we have a very young population, young people speaking more languages than older people, and we are extremely high educated. And so we are, when you're speaking about the Lisbon agenda, we are one of the cities in Europe that have to do that. It's when it's not working in a city like Utrecht, it's working never and nowhere. So cities like London, Hamburg, Munich, Utrecht, Stockholm, that is where it has to happen. So also the attention on cities and regional unities is very important for bring this topic further. Because exactly in this kind of cities, it's happening, and you can do something. These are the languages in the Utrecht situation that are spoken, more or less. And you see here that it's English, German, and French. And the level of German and French is going down. So that it's still there, but it's this is the level that the people that are speaking German, for example... and it is much lower than English. And that is one of the weak points we also had in the workshop, that it could be very interesting, especially to do something on German for us, because we have a lot of trade and commerce with Germany. So we know a little bit about, because we were thinking that we say young people are speaking more languages, high educated people, foreigners are speaking more languages, not totally true, because the non-Western are speaking a little bit less than the expats. And so you also see this in the problematic districts where they living together with the poor, not so well educated Dutch people. Coming back later to this, but we also have a separate survey on companies and smaller and middle-sized companies, and you see there more or less the same pattern, that a lot of languages are used for external and internal communication. This is when you relate what I said before, the cooperation and the relations with Germany is the biggest part of our external relations. And you see that German is only used in 60%. So that could be better, because it would be a very big advantage for Dutch companies to do it in German, because we already have a lot of knowledge about the language. There is what I can do after it is a lot of what was very nice, this thesis, this was prepared, 7 on language and social cohesion and cultural communication. Many of the slides could be say something about the one of the several topics. For example, there was one about... what is the next one? But here you see that there is a relation between the number of languages that are used actively in a company and the level of success. And 5 minutes, well, I'm already there. This is personal income and number of spoken languages. And here you see also that here after 5 people investing a lot of time in learning languages and then earning less money. The same is with cultural participation, that you have more cultural participation until 5 and then it's going down. Probably when you also asking for reading books. This is coming back to the survey on the population level, and what you see here is we found, for example, thesis number 2 was what is the effect of multilingualism on communities and community cohesion. It could be an interesting thing, because we have every language we ask for, where do you use it? And you see that the languages, Turkish, Arabic, Berber, are used almost always in their own community, in the family, with the friends, sometimes in Turkish, also in little enterprises. But surprisingly, is also that English, German, French, Italian, and Spanish a little bit, is also used a lot for intercultural communication with others in the city. So people use it for friends and work. This is the number of cross-ethnic friends. This is cultural participation. We see that's a... this is another research we did on a trainings institute, asking people, why do you learn a language? And you see that the top 2 is very clear. It's about the beauty of a language as a reason and planning to travel. So motivation is very close to the personal interest and not so much about work and study. And that could be helping to think how to mobilize people to learn new languages. And we start thinking about a project together with travel organizations and making very beautiful images of culture, traveling, and language. is this? Now, where are we now? It's just, for us, just the beginning to start to tell. We know something about our city. We want to offer a laboratory. What is interesting project? How can we introduce the topic in a more broader way? And we start to understand a little bit about motivation that could help to find the right projects. In 2009, we did a lot of things except this research. We have been walking around in the city, visiting all the institutes that are doing something with that could be interact on multilingualism. Website, we have a very big project with the Peace Treaty of Utrecht 2013. Some cooperation with the university. We have been making a lot of pictures and became aware of what's going on in the city. We have been traveling to other cities where we were thinking that something is going on. We have a first art project with translations from people in the neighborhood to translate old Dutch poems and vice versa. And for the coming year, we are working on this kind of projects. We think we can do a lot with art and translation and making objects about it and put it all around in the city to raise awareness. We do a project with our museum to open the collections in all kinds of languages. We don't have on this moment an international school, but we're working on it on the first one. We start project, for example, on the front desk with the municipality with badges. You can talk with me in that, that, and that language. So people, visitors, just the hospitality part of the thing. We are starting a working group with all kinds of institutions and starting what is the when we have so much money, what could be the projects in that we want to invest in to try out and to do something. We go on, especially with businesses, smaller and middle-sized business, to talk about what to do on German and Turkish, for example. We like to do international cooperation, but where are the partners who want to cooperate with us? Because we want to cooperate between university, good research, and city involvement, and politicians that will support that kind of thing. So the mixture could be very interesting. And how to relate this kind of topic to Olympic Games, sport events, cultural events, what to do with the topic in Marseille 2013 as cultural capital. We have to put it everywhere on the agenda. This morning we had about fundamental rights. Put it in the agenda. So let others do the work for us. And the last one, that were some questions. In England it's a bit difficult because you have the advantage that you already have the world language. But in general, I think that the language I'm talking about have to go from 3 to 4 languages. And in fact, it's also the discourse formulating for local politicians to because the adaptive language, what was formulated on the European level, I find out that politicians can deal with the story about 3 languages when you say, well, they are all 3 are the same level of importance. But we have a world language, a public language, and a home language for people at home, and that's it. And they start to use the concept. That's it, huh?
Very good. Well done, well done.
That's it. I'll take it.
Yep.
Thank you. Finally, we have Mike Reynolds in Sheffield.
Now, what's the drill for you? Oh, I see. What do I do?
Up and down. So the next one, listen up.
Right, okay. Like Hans, I think I'll take my coat off. It is hot in here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Apollo. It's centrally controlled.
Yeah. Like everything at the LSE.
Centrally controlling. Well, good afternoon. And I'd like to thank, first of all, the organisers of this for asking myself to come along and make this presentation, for including Sheffield amongst these really very impressive cities, certainly London and definitely Utrecht, where languages are concerned. You can see what it says here on the slide. I have sort of two hats here. I'm a city councillor, and I'm also a trustee of an organisation charity called Languages Sheffield, which I shall refer to a little bit later. Everybody, I think, knows where Sheffield is, yes? No? Well, we're in the sort of... we're in South Yorkshire, but on the fringes of the North Midlands. When the weather forecast comes up, I always wonder whether we are included in the Midlands or in the North, and that's important, especially in the last couple of days, to know where you are. We are... some people say we are the fourth largest city in England. Others say we're the fifth largest city in England. It depends how patriotic, in a sort of local patria chica sense, you are. Population is just over 500,000. We're going into a sister city relationship with a city in China called Chengdu, where the population is 7 million. So I suppose in their terms, we're a village. Over 500,000, but in fact, the population is rising. It's been it declined for about 20-odd years, but it's now beginning to climb. We're expecting it to be about 540 in about 10 years' time. And that population increase is mainly in the BME communities. BME communities make up about 15% of the city population. And you can see here the number of languages spoken. This is from the 2009-plus data in the schools, recorded as home languages in the schools, is 122. And when 2 years ago, or even less than that, David, you were writing the language education policy profile, we said it was only 90. So we've had a terrific increase in languages spoken in the schools in just the last couple of years. Mind you, it should be pointed out, and I will point out, that over 50% of those languages are spoken by between 1 and 10 speakers in the schools. So really we have a big five: Arabic, Bangla, Chinese. Notice it's Chinese. We don't distinguish, the PLUS data doesn't distinguish between Cantonese and Mandarin, and we have both in Sheffield, but Cantonese is the larger group. The Arabic speakers, they are from the Yemen. In the city, there are over 3,000, the Bangla speakers, and they, in fact, are probably really speakers of Sylhet rather than some standard Bangla. And I think that's the same situation in other cities, in London, for example, and other cities in the UK. But just under 2,000 is the community there. The Chinese community, just a little over 2,000. The Somali community, the most recent one to come into the city, but is really quite a large one now, over 4,000. But the largest of all is the Pakistani community, most of whom, of course, are not speakers of Urdu. Probably only about half or less than half are speakers of Urdu, but they are speakers of a variety of Punjabi known as Mirpuri, from the Mirpur region there in Pakistan. That's where they originate from. And we also have the new accession European languages, Polish. There are, in fact, now almost as many Polish speakers in the schools, primary, secondary, as there are Chinese speakers. And in fact, on that, I won't really digress onto this, but I must have a word with the Dean afterwards, because I think there's under-reporting where the Chinese community is concerned in the schools. I'll have a word with you perhaps afterwards about that. Okay. How do we support or try to support the community or the home languages in the city? One way is, I think, through the number of schools where you can take a GCSE in a community language. And in fact, Arabic is... there are 8 out of the 27 secondary schools where they enter pupils for Arabic. The results in 2009, which I think are probably still need to be confirmed, there were 50 entrants for Arabic, and 39 of those gained between the benchmark A star to C at GCSE. Chinese, nine of those 27 schools entered pupils for Chinese. 12, there were 14 entrants, 12 of them gained an A star. One gained a B, one gained an F. In Urdu, which is the best and the longest established, I think, of the community languages in the schools, 11 schools entered pupils, 83 total number of entrants, and 42, so just about half, gained A star to C. That number of entrants is dropping. I think about 2 or 3 years ago there were over 100 entrants for Urdu. So numbers of people taking Urdu are dropped. And as I said, Urdu is the language of only about half of the community, or children in the community, will speak Urdu. Much work could be done there. Complementary schools, there are over 20. We're not certain exactly how many. 20 are members of Languages Sheffield. There are 2 or 3, we're not quite certain how many, whether it's 3 or 4, that are not members of Languages Sheffield. These complementary schools cover 15 languages. Arabic, Somali, Urdu, Portuguese, Russian, Polish, 2 schools of Polish. And in fact, the oldest, the Polish Saturday School, was started in the 1940s. It's still going, so over 60 years it's been going. There's a Japanese school, there's a Greek school, and there's a French playgroup, not so much a school. Obviously, of course, that is support and it gets some support from the City Council, and so, in fact, do we in Languages Sheffield. And the way that we support, as I say, we're a charity, or we're a not-for-profit company also, and the aims of Languages Sheffield are to promote lifelong language learning, to promote also and extend existing plurilingualism in the city, and to support the city's complementary schools. And the way that that Languages Sheffield supports the languages, the complementary schools, is in support for is their management structures. Many of them are really sort of very basic and also really exist on a shoestring. So all sorts of management support, management systems, management or development of the curriculum, resource development as well, and training for volunteer teachers. Absolutely vital, that. And one of the things that the school, that Languages Sheffield is working with, 7 of these 20 schools are going through the process through the National Resource Centre for Supplementary Education, also known as CONTINU. They are being prepared and sort of sheltered through, ushered through the quality framework, a process for leading to quality framework awards. So in general, sort of a professionalisation, if you like, of the complementary schools. Another support system, and this really arose out of the Our Languages project, which you've got copies there, and Sarah has mentioned, the Somali Achievement Project. 3 schools working together. 2 of them are, in fact, 2 of the 4 specialist language colleges in Sheffield, and the other is, in fact, a primary school. This is excellent. So we've got secondary and primary together, working to raise the achievement of Somali pupils, because, in fact, it's one of the groups of that are underachieving, it is felt, within the city. Not as badly as, again, the white working class boys, but it is one of the groups that is underachieving. And that project, the SAP project, is developing, in the process of developing, a link with Rotterdam. Finally, on this matter of support, what we're calling the HOLA project, Home Language Accreditation. That's a consortium of Languages Sheffield, one of the specialist language colleges, King Edward VII, and the Children and Young Persons Services, 2 or 3 sections. There's a study support section, learning and achievement service within CYPS. So that's a consortium working together. It's really working out of developing from the Our Languages project, which did have 3 schools, I think, in Sheffield and 1 school in Leeds, working together on this, linking up the complementary and the mainstream sectors. And so the work of the HOLA project will be to further the links that already exist, but also to broaden them, so it would really include many more mainstream schools with many more of the complementary schools. And also there will be a family learning dimension in this as well, so that we encourage parents to encourage, if you like, the children to gain accreditation in their language, because many, of course, of the children don't, and that sort of parental engagement and parental push we see as being very, very important. All right. There is also, of course, the question, and I think it was referred to in the scoping documents, this is why I've really included it, what we do in the city for English as an additional language. Well, there's a list of the organisations that get involved in this, that both universities in the city do, but the programmes that they have are really aimed more, if you like, internally. Although they have large, both of them have large international summer schools, those summer schools, they provide programmes for their own students, of course, within the universities, but also on via the summer schools for those that are going to, say, leave Sheffield in many cases and go on to other UK universities. The Sheffield College, which is the one that the unitary further education institution in the city, does a lot. In fact, provides courses that they divide it into EFL and ESOL. They say ESOL. The EFL work is for not very, very different from what the universities do. It is preparing people for the standard, the Cambridge examinations, for example, in EFL. The ESOL work is for those, if you like, who live in the city, are going to stay in the city, in many cases refugees and also asylum seekers. But they've seen the numbers drop quite sharply of people who are able, particularly amongst refugees and asylum seekers, who can take ESOL courses or EAL courses. And this, of course, has been triggered by a change in government policy that happened a couple of years ago when free tuition was taken away, particularly from asylum seekers, and even as it stands, the government policy does not allow an asylum seeker to get any free provision of EAL for at least the first 6 months after they've lodged, registered their claim to asylum and to refugee status. So the Sheffield College, in a way, suffers from this government policy. And it's not just the college that suffers. I think the asylum seekers and the refugees themselves suffer from this policy. MTAS, earlier we had a reference to EMAG, Ethnic Minority Achievement Grant. MTAS is the part of the City Council, it stands for the Ethnic Minority and Traveller Achievement Service. And they also provide, well, they provide support to over half of the schools in the city, and their benchmark is, are there more than 10% of BME pupils in the school? In that case, then they will qualify for support from MTAS. But they also support several hundred pupils in schools which don't reach that benchmark level of 10%. Further work is done by the Adults and Community Learning Service, yet another part of the Children and Young Person Services. They run, or ran rather, a couple of years ago, over 90 courses citywide. But also an important work is done in this area by the voluntary community sector. SAVTE, standing up for Sheffield Association for the Voluntary Teaching of English, they work on a one-to-one home tuition basis. And what's very interesting, I think, in their work is that they reach most of the people that come to them on this one-to-one system and then graduate onto course, into groups and coursework, and often onto accredited courses. The majority of people they work with are women, and sometimes these are a difficult to reach group in some of the BME communities. WEA do quite a bit of work, and ASSIST. ASSIST is an organisation that works particularly with asylum seekers and with destitute asylum seekers, failed asylum seekers, as they're sometimes called. Right. Very, very briefly, certain bits of research have been done into various communities, and I've listed there the four communities where some work has been done. And just, I've got some copies of the fuller list of references, so if anybody is interested, I can just give those to you, and will happily do so. The communities cover the Somalis, the Yemeni community. That's ongoing work from Gibson Ferguson. He's still continuing that research into the Yemenis, African Caribbean Youth, and Punjabi Urdu. The general picture is one of shift, language shift and language loss over the generations. The work that I did with the Punjabi Urdu community showed, however, that that is quite a gradual process. It's not rapid, although we had people in the third generation. And you get a development also of a mixed code and fusion between English, the same finding with the Afro-Caribbean group. There's a need for much further research, and that's highlighted in the second bullet point there, the language education policy profile that David was the rapporteur for, which arose out of a city languages strategy which we launched in 2004. We think we were the first city in the country to have a city languages strategy. However, it remained, and I think remains, Sheffield's best-kept secret. The Council of Europe, and we were really very grateful and pleased that they came, and in fact, I have to thank LIDV, because LIDV was very much instrumental in enlisting the Council of Europe to do this profile. First city in Europe to be profiled. We're rather proud of that. And it's leading into a revised city languages strategy, which will take aboard... We say city strategy rather than education, because we're determined and we're reasonably successful in getting the business sector and, less successful yet, but we're still working on it, the public sector involved with the education sector in producing what is really a city languages strategy for language learning and language use. Finally, or almost finally, languages and city strategies. We do have this status of, and we were the first city, there are now I think 11 cities in the country, to get city of sanctuary status. And there's just a little statement there of what is at the core of the city of sanctuary manifesto. A city that takes pride in the welcome it offers to people in need of safety and that enables asylum seekers and refugees to contribute fully to the life of our communities. And that, of course, must also that involves the learning of English. And let's go on to this community cohesion strategy. It's a fine-looking document in many ways. It has a definition of community cohesion, which it looks as though I probably haven't got time to read, so I won't. Many of the case studies in this strategy refer to the learning of English. And what I bemoan is there is a lack of recognition of the contribution of the community languages and the home languages to community cohesion. And that dimension needs to be brought in and written in and written up and acted on in a community cohesion strategy. The other strategy where languages clearly fit in is in the international strategy, which is in the process of being developed. And so we have a chance, I think, and we must take that chance in the city to get languages really written into the international strategy. It began as something purely economic. We've managed to broaden it now so they will look at social and cultural and educational dimensions. But in all four of those dimensions, languages must be in there. When I think about these strategies, I'm reminded of the phrase that Joshua Fishman used about languages when he referred to languages. I think he was talking about New York City as the elephant in the room. And that's true. It is the elephant in the room where these strategies are concerned. And that's it, it seems. Last slide.
Well, thanks all three. It was very interesting to see lots of connections there, the connections between language and cognition and education and the benefits that are in there, the connections between language and tolerance and respect, and indeed connections between language and voting, which I think, if nothing else, the current government might hear if they're even deaf to the other points. Also a reminder of the reality of the challenges and opportunities that are brought about in this passage beyond monolingualism in Europe today, and indeed of its cities of sanctuary as places of welcome, of proud welcome to others. And finally, the various languages of languages that was visible there, home languages, public languages, private languages, heritage languages, native languages, national languages, global languages, first languages, additional languages, and finally the deleterious effects of six languages. Now we have time. We're going to push the final bit back a bit, so this summing up is going to be a bit shorter and sweeter, and give you a little bit more time now to make some points of your own. So I'm going to just let you speak now, but if you could wait for the microphone to arrive at you, that would be very helpful. And at this point, I'll leave anybody to say anything. So if you just give a little signal, and we'll get a mic your way. Come on, you've had lots of time to think now, not a lot of time to speak. So you should take this opportunity. Or you all want to go home.
Not yet.
No, you can't go home yet, so you must ask a question. Yeah, please.
I actually have yet another question that I would like to take the opportunity to put to all your all the education and teaching practitioners in the room. For the coming program period that I spoke about before, we are talking an awful lot about mobility. You know, we have already a lot of programs that favor mobility. We have Erasmus for university students. We have Leonardo da Vinci for professional education and training that makes it possible for apprentices, for instance, to do a work placement in another country. It's all about going abroad to learn, basically, and to learn lots of things, but of course also languages and cultural competence. Now, from my unit, we would like to. There is a language element in all these programs of mobility. Of course, there is. There is no international mobility without language practice. But we would like to put the focus even more on languages for mobility. We would like to try to create maybe a mobility program in its own right in order to learn languages. And I've heard a lot here today about establishments teaching mainly English, but certainly also Dutch in Utrecht, as additional language. You have establishments that are specialized in teaching national languages to foreigners. Now, do you think that being able to find European support would have a value for going abroad for a short period of time, just a short period of time, from two to four weeks, on a language course? And why not during the summer holidays? Do you think that this could be something that would be valuable as a booster for the interest to learn languages as a whole? Could that be, even if it's not directly linked to any other particular purpose than just for learning languages? That's what I would like to know.
Thank you. That's a good provocation. Come on, practitioners.
Je vais faire de la diversité linguistique, je vais parler en français.
Merci.
Je pense que là, vous allez avoir du public, parce qu'effectivement, si la demande est extrêmement forte, Et les programmes actuellement qui existent sont très particuliers. Peu d'étudiants peuvent, enfin, un grand nombre partent, mais par rapport au nombre d'étudiants que nous avons et d'élèves, si on ouvre encore à des étudiants, enfin des élèves du secondaire, je crois que là vous allez être submergés de demandes. En tout cas pour la France, je pense que je peux déjà dire, mes collègues sont là ou je ne sais pas s'ils sont partis, qu'il y aura une énorme demande si c'est quelque chose comme ça, si c'est uniquement pour la langue, pour la pratique de la langue. Donc votre question, je veux dire, votre question est une réponse à une question qui est posée depuis longtemps.
Well, we have some time. Yeah. Let's down here first. Yeah.
My question is around Kate, the presentation. It's a very very fascinating presentation, I think it was. It's really bread and butter, global identity to global citizenship. I think we raised this question time and again in previously and now in terms of there's a huge challenge that schools are facing in terms of when we are talking about teaching language. And when we are talking about the, not just only language, citizenship as well, and the cohesion as well. And then there is an impact in terms of the development of understanding about the school's leadership as well as the frontline teaching staff. And what should we be doing about that? What sort of strategic direction that we need to take? Or is there any kind of... what do we need to put into the policy, and will there be something into the policy? And there are huge the funding issues as well surrounding all of this agenda. So... Just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I mean, in a sense, I'm not sure in terms of what the policy should be in terms of languages, but thinking about it, and actually thinking about it in terms of the conversation that we had before lunch, it does seem to me that there should be a sort of a bit of a pick-and-mix approach, and all languages can't be treated in exactly the same way. I mean, someone was saying very clearly that for employability, that languages, that European languages are important, so French and German, that they're important. For identity, I mean, presumably individual children want to know more about their own culture, take their own first language further, but that doesn't necessarily help cohesion. And so for cohesion, you want people who don't speak Punjabi or what have you to be learning that as part of the community thing. And it seems to me that you then have a whole list of different possible languages that a school could engage in. And they can't engage in all of them academically in terms of an hour a week in the timetable. So presumably then you've got to look at extended schooling, you've got to look at complementary schools, you've got to look at all sorts of other ways in which other languages can be brought into the space. And you can't ignore employability, can you? Because you want them to learn standard English for employability. So you can't ignore that in terms of European languages. But there could also be spaces in other ways, different and perhaps more imaginative ways, for other languages to be introduced as well.
I'd just like to put, going back to the offer for a sort of Lingua 2, son of Lingua, daughter of Lingua, cousin of Lingua programme. I do think the pickup rate would be large. I just know I speak with... I'm looking after the Confucius Institute for London, for business rather, here at the LSE. And one of the things we found so useful is that there are so many grants, so many scholarships, so much money available from China to actually send people over. And it really has made a big difference. We actually have waiting lists now of people wanting to get onto language courses in China. If we could actually replicate that excitement and sense of the new... In other languages, I really think there would be a huge pickup. Admittedly, we're talking about university sector, but I really do think that it would spread right down the sector as well.
Yeah, Lyd.
Can I just... it's cheating a bit, isn't it? Could I just pick up on that? Just because we've got time to say it, but just one thing about that. Remember the question about... or the issue about existing... multilingualism of the elites, and I don't think that a European programme should necessarily be developed in order to promulgate that. And the big difficulty is reaching some of the parts that we've been hearing about today, and providing support for that. And how you would do that in an equitable way is a problem for the bureaucrats, but it is a problem, isn't it? Because that's who we would want to be involved in that. Some of the people that Keith has been talking about as well. And how do you design a program around that, I think, is an interesting challenge.
Perhaps a few ideas for ways thinking about something extra. Perhaps it's interesting to make combinations with big events where people coming together from all over Europe in sport or culture. And for example, there is a new phenomenon. It's called the European Youth Olympic Festival. It started in Tallinn, I think, 2007, and every 2 years, and thousands of young people coming in the city together, and they communicate by sport, but say leaving the game, and then you can start with something else. For example, tasting each other's languages, and you can prepare preparing to go to such an event. You can also create you have languages that can understand each other, lenguas receptiva. Well, how to train people on, to let experience what is possible with Italian and Spanish, French, or German and Dutch, and bring it together. Make Skype friends, make these kind of programs that they can talk after it and go on exercising. Invest in augmented realities, that when you do such programs, people walking around in another. And start to make layers of realities that other citizens going of your language going somewhere to Krakow that you can see through your mobile in 5 years that someone else coming from Germany has been there and put some information in German on Polish reality. Well, it's difficult to explain, but there is all kinds of things start to become possible with mobiles, phones, because you. There is a compass in it, and there is a GPS in it, and you can place information, all kind of languages, in certain situations. Also, learning language, learning programs, for example. And do something with businesses, because it's the competitiveness of our countries in Europe, and also the concept of receptiva, that companies can deal with each other without speaking their own of the one of the two languages very well, they can go on understanding each other. That's it.
Okay, thank you. One down here, yeah.
Can I make the suggestion that if you're looking to send teachers abroad, you might consider either teachers of geography rather than straight language teachers, or in particular teachers of PE or drama. And the reason behind that is if you can get those people to go abroad, learn a foreign language and come back, then they can build some of that into their teaching. And in particular for the less able, where learning is linked to physical movement, as in drama and PE in particular, then it becomes far more sticky. So perhaps actually consider sending people who are not really language specialists abroad to try and get them to come back and pull it in. And once you kind of get a groundswell of a positive nature about a language, I think it goes much more. Fine, you were asking the question, I was making the suggestion. I'm delighted.
Thank you.
I wonder whether I could raise the question of the relationship between the city experience of community and the national experience of community. And we've talked quite a lot about identity earlier in the day. I'm reminded, obviously, of the traditional notion of national identity as part of an imagined community, whereas the kind of city experiences that we've been hearing about are very much face-to-face, real contact communities rather than imagined ones. And I wonder whether cities manage better without a sense of a cohesive identity because they don't need to make that effort of imagination.
Find them now.
Don't mind me.
Continue.
Because I will have to
leave. All right. Sorry. Where are we? Who wants to talk about national and local?
I would just make a comment about. Even within cities, we tend to have the idea of a community. So we talk about the Somali community. But in fact, there's more than one Somali community in Sheffield. There are three different versions of the Polish community in Sheffield. They represent historic waves of immigration, migration. In the case of the Somalis, they represent, in fact, bitterly opposed groups that derive from the circumstances back home and the division of that country. So the notion, indeed, of a... And in fact, even the linguistic community, I mentioned in a way with the Urdu Punjabi Urdu community, there are five or six or seven varieties of language, and therefore of of political allegiance and geographical allegiance within that one community. Plus the fact then, of course, that now we're talking about communities of people, many of whom were born in this country. So we're dealing with an intensely complex notion. And we just use this term community as a blanket term, and rather loosely.
Yes, I think that's also probably true of identity. I mean, I think Sir Keith talked about the different layers and levels and things like this, but there's also a very important... thought there of that instead of thinking that you might, as it were, begin at the bottom, you have my personal one, then my E7 one, and then my next one until you get up to some kind of cosmopolitan global thing, you also have identities which are modified in their relation to another. So, for example, in Britain, you could talk about the Europeanisation of a British identity, and it may be rather minor and rather invisible at times, but it's certainly not entirely negligible, and that would be true all over Europe. You don't have to say, well, the question was raised about whether we feel European or not. Anyone who lives in Europe, you can have something like the Europeanisation of identity without ever passing through the name of Europe, and it's sometimes a kind of fetish that we have, that we think that identity is bound up with a name, and it's almost invariably not. But anyway, other questions? We're going to have to draw a close to that there. Okay, that was me finishing. That was very good. So
we like to write, Simon.
Right, I'm now handing back, and there's going to be some closing words with summing up in the next stage. Who's going to do it?
Yes, first of all, we are going to finish more or less on time. There will be coffee, tea, buns outside ready. We would like to thank you all for being so attentive and so involved in the discussions, and also like to thank all the panel members, the speakers, the chairs. I will give the final word to Lyd. And I don't think it's going to be a summing up, because it's too much to sum up. But this is really the end of the first paragraph. The second paragraph will be beginning later, February the 4th.
Thank you very much. Well, I could surprise you all now by telling you this is the final version. I've summed it all up lovely. There it is, but I'm not going to. I think we said at the beginning that this was about developing more questions. I think we've achieved that aim anyway, and I hope you've been warm, and I hope you get home safely and all the other objectives. And I certainly hope you've enjoyed yourselves, and I think most people have, and it's been quite a tiring day by the end of it. Clearly, we want some feedback from you, but I'm not going to ask you to do that now. We'll send you an email and ask you to respond to it, both about things like how it went for you and all of that. That's important, but also, particularly if you've got an evaluator sitting over there, but also issues that you want to take forward, because I think we've captured a lot, but there could well be, you never have the opportunity to see everything you want. You might think of it on the train, so we'll give you some space for doing that. I've been sort of listening fascinated for most of the afternoon. I've just got lists of things: identity, coherence, perceptions, all of those issues playing around, and it seemed to get, at one point, as it always does, more and more complicated. But then I saw a couple of things coming out of the complication, which I thought, well, maybe let's think about that rather more. There's something in there about how we train language teachers, I think, and where language teachers are sitting and what they do and what their perceptions are and how they respond to this very demanding and complicated situation. But I think also it came up in our discussion, and it came up again today, the getting away from the idea, starting from the idea that there is not a hierarchy, but then moving of languages, but then moving beyond that, as Keith said and others have said, to say, but there are differences, and those differences are very, very important. And the word has not been used, it's a Council of Europe word, the idea of the plurilingual repertoire of individuals and how their language competence is not GCSEs in a long row, but all kinds of different things. How do we respond to that, and how do we support policy to understand that in relation, I think that's more broadly, but in relation specifically to this issue, I think there's some very interesting things in there to take further. And I also have to say, because it's so complex, I think one of the ideas I'm going to take away from this was Dina's idea. If something's really complex, wasn't it good to find a very simple thing that people can understand so that they can get into the complexity? And whether it's healthy eating or whatever the image might be, healthy language brain, I think that's a really very interesting idea. But that's really as far as I've got, because I'm still, as we said, this is continuing. I'm still relying on your input over the next... we are relying on your input over the next weeks and months. That means firstly responding to, hopefully it's going to be a nice Christmas present for us, won't it? I don't imagine we'll do anything much with it, but you might get it done before Christmas, to an email next week. Incidentally, in that respect, we're very keen to develop ongoing dialogue. If there's anybody who, up till now, we've been carefully keeping your emails separate from all of you. If there's anybody who would like us to do that, we'll carry on doing that. But if you're happy for your emails, which are mainly public emails, I think, in other words, you to be sent out on a common address so you can see who everybody else is if you wanted to talk to them, then we'll do that. If you don't want that to happen, please tell Yvonne or tell Susie. We'll alert you to that as well. But I think that's an easy way of doing it. So that will happen. What we're looking for also, as we develop the website, the scoping document with additions will start to go up, and we invite you to contribute. So I know some people already have said, well, I'd like to write a little piece about that. Send it in and we'll sort it out as we work around a summary of this conference. In relation to that, could the group leaders, I think probably Imca, I mentioned Susie and Ivana, but Imca has been patiently scribing things today. And if you could give any notes to Imca today, that would save you having to do it later. I think, but they need to be legible. I think that's as far as I've got. Do you want to say a little? Do your little advertisement, Nick? Yeah, but 10 seconds.
I'll even try it. Yeah, 17 seconds. Apologies to those who've heard already. I wonder if Baroness Cousins came up with the APPG idea that we were trying to make each political party make statements about language learning in their manifesto. And the way to do this, we decided, was
to use the microphone. No, was to use to contact each MP and ask them to make, in the light of the statements by the CBI and indeed the issue of social cohesion, what their view was on the importance of learning a language. And we would put these replies then on a website for all to see. That's obviously been tried as a strategy before. The new approach would be to get schools and their constituencies to write to them, because it would be very difficult for an MP not to reply to a student in their constituency asking a question about languages. So a tentative name at the moment is the Wall of Language. We may change this, but could I really ask you, as the great and the good of the language world, if this comes, then to try and drum up support at all levels so that we can politicise this this more and to try and get some sort of clarification. Thank you. 17 seconds, wow.
All right, well done. Thank you very much. So that's an initiative that's been taking place there. I'm sure there are other initiatives you want to share. You can do so over a cup of coffee. And can I add to what Nick has said, thank you all so much for participating actively. I hope you're not too exhausted, but stimulated, and we'll go off into your various journeys all over the world, still thinking about the things we've been talking about. Thank you very much. see your name.